Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is planetary scientist, Dr. Alan Stern. Alan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Hey, it's a pleasure to have you on the show. We always like to hear from astrophysicists and highly technical people, because that's my background too. And you've done some amazing things. You are a PhD planetary scientist. You're the principal investigator for the Pluto New Horizons mission. You're the chief scientist for Worldview High Altitude Ballooning. And you've done many, many other awesome things. And we will get to that in the later part of the show. But first, I wanted to ask you, as I do with many scientists, because it's an interesting story, is how you became inspired to become a planetary scientist.
Well, ever since I can remember, I was interested in becoming involved in space exploration. Even as a little boy, the start of grade school, I remember wanting to grow up and find some career in that line of work that I just couldn't wait to jump on board and be a part of that Star Trek future.
Ah, Star Trek. Common now, theme.
and then as I went to college, and I studied physics, and I was taking a lot of astronomy courses. And the one that excited me the most was the solar system course, because first, the planets are reachable by spacecraft, whereas the stars are not. And so I thought that, in the space of my career, that we would have a lot more opportunity to go to those places rather than just observe them from afar. And that was my attraction to planetary science. And I'm glad I made that choice. It's been a lot of fun.
Did your parents influence you? Were your parents technical?
No, my dad was a salesman for a very large chemical concern and then ended up in executive management. My mom was an accountant who really didn't work after my siblings and I were born. And they encouraged me, in my interests and hobbies as a kid. But I think more than anything, and all three of us kids thank our lucky stars, because you don't get to choose your parents, but all three of us in the family I grew up in, I think that our parents played a huge role in driving us to be high achievers.
So you got your bachelor's degree in physics and astronomy.
And two different, right.
Then you went on to get a master's in aerospace engineering and planetary atmospheres. That's a kind of an interesting twist, the aerospace engineering part especially. It kind of sounds like you were already thinking about spacecraft engineering at that point.
A little bit. I got that quartet of degrees really because I wanted to be an astronaut, and I wanted to show that I was versatile. I could make good grades and so forth in a variety of different technical specialties relevant to the job.
And you thought aerospace engineering would tie into manned spaceflight?
Of course. Yeah, and I was doing other things, becoming a private pilot and learning to scuba dive and parachute and paramedic and eventually a flight instructor and things like that.
When did you learn to fly?
During a Christmas break between graduation from college in December and the start of graduate school in January.
Was this with the typical Cessnas and Bonanzas?
Yep. Started off with Cessnas flying out of Dallas Love Field. Caught by a Strategic Air Command bomber left seat commander who was just a great instructor.
Cool. I did Cessna 150s at Eglin Air Force Base. That was interesting. Almost got run over by some F-4s.
I bet that was it.
It was. I came close to auguring in. Then you went on to get your PhD, and you did that right here in Colorado, at the University of Colorado. I wanted to ask you, was that because of the proximity of Ball Aerospace and Lockheed Martin and CU's reputation? What drove you from Texas to Colorado?
Oh, well, when I finished my two master's degrees in December of 1981, my wife and I moved to Colorado because of a combination of my love for skiing and a job offer I got at Martin Marietta, which later became a part of Lockheed Martin.
Lockheed Martin, yeah. Same here. Skiing. Yep.
Yeah. I thought I'd come and ski for a year, maybe two, and get some experience, and then go back to Houston and work for NASA. But I ended up at a large research laboratory at the University of Colorado called LASP, and working directly for the director, and did that for a number of years. And one of the projects that I worked on, and this is a bit of a story, so bear with me. One of the projects that I worked on was to put a satellite on a space shuttle to observe Halley's Comet. Unfortunately, that satellite flew on the Challenger mission that exploded shortly after launch.
No.
And you might remember that in addition to the tragedy for the people and their families and the space shuttle program, that the whole space enterprise that NASA was conducting ground to an immediate halt and stayed that way for years, because everything was launching on the shuttle and the shuttle was grounded. There were no Atlases and Deltas and other rockets, Falcons back then. So during these years that I had been working for the laboratory director, I had been more and more attracted to change from an engineering career to a science career. And then when everything went on hiatus for 3 years, I thought, well, this is my opportunity. I'll go back to graduate school and get my PhD, my union card for doing science. And I only applied to one school. I applied to the University of Colorado because, A, I knew many of the faculty professionally and knew it was a top-ranked school, but also we had a house and a baby and two jobs here, and I didn't want to upend all that just to go to graduate school. So since CU was so highly ranked in the space sciences, I just took the one shot, and they accepted me, and went to grad school here, finished in 89.
What was your thesis topic?
On Oort clouds around other stars and the processes that cause comets to evolve in our Oort cloud and others.
Oh, can we see or detect Oort clouds around other stars?
Well, it turns out we can now. Then... I was writing theory papers about how you might someday do it. In fact, one of those that was published in Nature actually panned out, in the very precise technique that I described in a paper in the early 1990s turned out to be something that was later done in the mid-2000s to detect comets around other stars.
So real quick, just let's take a subroutine here and explain to the listeners what an Oort cloud is around a star.
Yeah, well, it's a funny name. It's spelled O-O-R-T after the Dutch astronomer, planetary scientist named Jan Oort, who first postulated it. Oort realized in the middle of the 20th century that all the long-period comets, all those with long orbital periods, seemed to be coming from a similar location, a spherical shell around the planetary system located tens of thousands of times further from the sun than the Earth. And that assemblage...
Astronomical units. You can say it.
Yeah. So that assemblage...
The listeners are technical. I'll get that.
Good, good. So that assemblage was later dubbed the Oort cloud, and that's what Oort clouds are.
Cool, cool. And so very slight perturbations of nearby stars, as I understand it, can cause a comet to leave the Oort cloud and come hurtling in towards the sun.
Right. It can also cause a comet to leave the Oort cloud and go out in interstellar space. And other things can jostle the orbits the same way, like the passages of giant molecular clouds. And the way that the Oort cloud was formed was through the natural process where the giant planets were cleaning up all the debris and ejecting it out of the middle of the solar system, the middle of the planetary system anyway. And so at the time we thought, and today we know even better, that solar systems that have architectures like our own normally create Oort clouds, that we should expect to find Oort clouds around other stars when there are giant planets at similar distances.
Okay, we got to move on. We'll talk about that in a related thing in a bit. But now I want to move on and ask you about after your doctorate. Did you move right away to the Southwest Research Institute? Did I get that right?
It is called the Southwest Research Institute. I spent a year postdocing here in Boulder, applying for various jobs and picking the one that I wanted. So I think, let's see, I got my degree in December of 89 and moved to Texas in the fall of 91. So I was 2 years in Boulder before I got to Southwest.
And then how did you end up at NASA? Was that 95?
I ended up at NASA in 2007 and 8. And the administrator of NASA at the time, Mike Griffin, who I'd known for quite some time and who I'd worked with, asked me to replace the exiting, really retiring chief of all the science programs, an astronaut named Mary Cleave. He asked me if I'd come work for him and run the entire science enterprise at NASA headquarters for all the missions from the rovers on Mars to the Hubble Space Telescope to all the things that look at the Earth and the Sun and everything else and all the research programs as well. So I said yes to that and moved 1,500 miles to the East Coast.
I was trying to fit in there how you became a candidate for payload specialist. Was that before or after? I think I'm out of order here.
Yeah, we're a little out of order. That's all right. In the 1990s, I applied to be an astronaut several times, and I kept getting closer and closer, and finally I got down to the, you know, out of thousands of applicants, down to the 100 or so that get interviewed in Houston and go through medical tests. I did not get selected in that round, but as it turned out, the next year, one of the experiments that I was flying on Space Shuttle to look at a different comet, Hale-Bopp, was selected to have me fly with it as a payload specialist on the shuttle.
Cool. Did that happen?
It did not happen, as it turned out, unfortunately. Kind of broke my heart, but the NASA administrator of the day, a guy named Dan Golden, decided to do a deal with the Canadian Space Agency, an international agreement that involved flying a Canadian astronaut on that same flight, and there was no more space available. So I got to walk the plank.
Tough. Well, just for the sake of the listeners, if you want to become an astronaut, flight training is very important. Take those private pilot lessons, get into sailplanes or whatever, figure out how to fly a business jet, get some aviation training, right? Is that
Absolutely.
Your advice?
Yeah, and it's not really that it's flight training, although it's obviously applicable to flying spacecraft, but it's that you get your head out of the books and show that you can do things that are operational. And that's why a lot of people who've taken that course, like myself, you know, in applying, did all kinds of other things like riding on ambulances as a paramedic and, you know, going to South Pole and learning to scuba dive and parachute. I flew F-18 jets and U-2 derivative called WB-57 on NASA missions. So it was, I did a lot more than just the general aviation end of things. But any of that helps if you're applying for those kind of jobs.
Yeah, that is very important. So, I think this is a good point for us to take a break. And when we come back, I want to ask you some more about your career arc and some cool planetary stuff. But first, we have to do a commercial break. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds with Dr. Alan Stern. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous background mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. We're talking with Dr. Alan Stern, planetary scientist. Before the break, Dr. Stern, you were telling me about the NASA work you did with science missions. And tell me more about that. What did that involve, and how did you achieve the results that you did with the cost savings?
Well, first as background for your listeners, all of the NASA science programs in earth science, astrophysics, planetary science, and in heliophysics are run from Washington, D.C. at NASA headquarters, from an organization within NASA headquarters called the Science Mission Directorate, which is responsible for about 100 different science missions at any given time. Some are in design, some are in build, many are in flight, some are in their extended missions. They've accomplished their primary mission. And also all the research programs that go on to turn all those ones and zeros into meaningful discoveries. I was appointed the head of the Science Mission Directorate. That was announced at the beginning of 2007. And as I said, I moved out to Washington to lead that organization and to lead the science enterprise at NASA. I did it in 2007 and 2008 and left NASA in 2008. And while we were there, I thought that we accomplished a lot. And I have to give a lot of credit to the people that worked with me in the front office of the Science Mission Directorate, and also to the individual division directors and their staffs. But we made a lot of positive changes in the way that missions are selected, in the way that grants are selected and managed. We eliminated some bureaucracy. I think probably most notably, we selected more new missions, gave them a start in that short period of time than had ever been done before. And we cut back drastically on overruns, which were then a significant problem for NASA. Overruns in the science mission.
Was that mission creep, or was it administrative, or what?
Oh, sometimes it was mission race. It was more than just creep. There were a variety of different reasons that different missions would lose control of their cost. Sometimes they were the mission's fault. Sometimes they were the agency's fault. Sometimes they were nobody's fault. For example, a hurricane would eliminate a launch window, and a mission would have to sit on the ground for years to wait for the planets to align again. But usually they were due to some human issues, some management issues. And we were able to cut the overruns by 63% the first year.
Were you involved in the inception of the New Horizons to Pluto at that point?
Yeah. Not at that point, though. I worked as a scientist helping to convince NASA that there should be an exploration mission to Pluto for about a dozen years, from 89 until 2001, when NASA had a call for proposals to explore Pluto. And I was asked to lead a proposal, one of the proposals in that competition, which ultimately became New Horizons and which ultimately won the competition. We were selected in November of 2001. We launched in January of 2006. And then shortly after we got in flight, I stepped away from my scientific career to do this science mission director leadership in 07 and 08.
Tell me about how a mission like that is planned. I mean, it's so just kind of an overview. I mean, there's so many things to attend to. There's the energy management. I think New Horizons flew with an RTG, right? Radioisotope thermoelectric generator, because it's so far from the sun.
That's right.
And then did you have multiple computers like the space shuttle where they made decisions and would vote one guy out if he got zapped by some sort of event?
In our case, we fly redundant hardware for almost everything on the spacecraft. So the main computer's got a backup. Mm-hmm. That's in case it fails. We can fail over to the backup and still have a main computer, but they don't operate simultaneously. We don't have the power to do that. We don't really need to, because the space shuttle computers only ran synced up like that during very time critical launch and reentry periods. We're on 9.5-year flight across the solar system to Pluto. Most time, things are happening pretty slowly, so there's no requirement for that.
Is this computer a special fabrication technique that's radiation resistive, like military hardware, or is it the kind of thing you'd buy at an Apple store?
It's the former. In fact, not only space radiation, but the radiation from our own power supply, our nuclear battery, has to be shielded against, not just for the computer, but for all the electronics on the scientific instruments and on the spacecraft. So there are other computers on board, as well as many other kinds of electronics. There are state machines, for example. They all have to be shielded against space radiation and RTG radiation.
Tell me about the decision to approach Pluto and record, but then transmit afterwards. Did I get that right?
Yeah, sure. Well, New Horizons is background. In order to win, we had to, there was a number of tall challenges, and one of them was that we had to do something a lot of people thought you couldn't do, which is fly a mission like Voyager, you know, which explored the giant planets over a dozen years, a mission that went farther and was launched faster and which carried much more sophisticated scientific instruments, but do it on only 20% of the budget of Voyager. So there were a number of different things that we did to get the cost down. And among those was a decision that we could save a lot on cost if we took a long time to send the data back. And the logic was if you flew 9.5 years to go get the data, there was very little risk in taking one additional year to get the data back to Earth. But by doing that, we were able not only to save a lot on our telecommunications system, which is redundant, so you pay for it twice, but we were also able to have a much lower power draw for telecommunications, and that in turn let us fly with only one instead of two of these RTG power supplies, and they're expensive. Those are individually in the range of $60 or $70 million a piece, and then you have to go through a very extensive nuclear safety and approval program in the federal government to get permission to launch. Anyway, the long story short is, through sort of a stroke of genius, this one decision to transmit the data back slowly after the flyby rather than in real time ended up being an enormous part of the cost savings that made it possible to do it for 1/5 the cost of Voyager.
Wow, and it's been a great success, too. You've gotten all the data you want so far?
We've gotten all the data from the Pluto system. We checked every box, and in most cases we got higher grades than we said we were aiming for when we wrote the proposal. That is, we got higher resolution images or more colors or studied more bodies. You know, Pluto has 5 moons that we know of now. All that. So it was a smashing success. And by the way, if you don't mind, the whole story of how this came to happen, how the spacecraft was designed, the whole flight and the Pluto flyby, is coming out next year in a book by myself and David Grinspoon. To be published in the spring of next year. It's called Chasing New Horizons.
Excellent. Do you have any kind of Amazon link yet, or is it not ready? I'll put it in the show notes if it is.
Not just yet, the publishing house, which is Picador, a unit of Macmillan, will be taking care of all that in the spring as we lead up to the release of the book.
Excellent. I'll put it in the show notes anyway, even if we don't have a link. So what's next for New Horizons? Is it going to head outwards and still provide information about the deep space?
Yeah, our original mission objective was to study not just Pluto, but the Kuiper Belt itself, where Pluto orbits. And so we were just approved last year for a new 5-year mission, an extended mission to travel almost twice as far from the sun as Pluto, conduct another close flyby of another body in the Kuiper Belt, and conduct dozens of observations of other Kuiper Belt objects that we pass close to, and study the Kuiper Belt environment, you know, charged particle radiation, the dust environment, other aspects of it as well. So we're doing that and doing it very well. The flyby will take place 16 months from now on a very easy date to remember for your listeners, the 1st of January 2019. So come spend your New Year's with NASA and watch us explore the farthest worlds ever explored in the history of humankind.
Awesome. Awesome.
Beyond Pluto.
I read that you'd had some thoughts about the demotion of Pluto from being a planet to a dwarf planet. Can you briefly tell us about that? Because that's, I think, somebody, everybody knows about that a little bit, wondering how that decision was made in your thoughts.
Well, you told me that this was a show where curse words aren't used. So this will take longer.
Well, we only have a few minutes left.
Maybe I can use curse acronyms like the
Honestly,
as a planetary scientist, I thought that what the astronomers did in 2006, a professional group of people who don't even study planets for a living, was a scientific tragedy. A scientific travesty, in that they created an essentially unworkable definition for planets, specifically designed only to do one thing, to manage the number of planets to be a short list in our lists.
Something to do with clearing out its space and some other weird, wacko definitions.
All of this was made up simply to keep the number of planets low. You know, we don't try to manage the number of mountains on the Earth to be something we can memorize, or the number of rivers, or the number of species, or the number of minerals, or for that matter, the number of elements in the periodic table. It's absolutely ascientific to operate this way.
So what is your view about the definition of a planet?
Well, it's very simple. When objects grow to be sufficiently large that they become spherical due to their own self-gravity, we call them planets. And Pluto fits that category. In fact, it's about 10 times bigger than the smallest objects that do this. And it turns out that small planets are very numerous in our solar system and probably in the galaxy. And that's just the data. And the fact that small planets outnumber medium-sized planets and big planets is a revolution in my field. But it's not a reason to categorize them differently from planets any more than we exclude dwarf stars from the category of stars. If we did, by the way, the sun, which is itself a dwarf star, would be excluded. Wouldn't that be ridiculous?
Well, I think I agree with you. You've convinced me. I like it.
Well, it turns out in planetary science, I think most people think that way. Unfortunately, most of the science press has never really told the story that the wrong people were doing the classification. Astronomers, people in a neighboring field. It's sort of like divorce lawyers arguing to the Supreme Court about real estate law. wrong specialty. It's sort of like going to, being diagnosed with a brain problem and going to a podiatrist. Sorry, wrong specialty. Neighboring specialty. Still a doctor. Wrong kind of doctor. The astronomers really have no expertise in this area, and they botched it up.
All right. Well, you convinced me. I like your definition. Well, we only have a few minutes left, so I'd have time for one more topic. Do you want to talk about worldview or something else?
I would love to talk about worldview.
Let's talk about that. Worldview, high-altitude ballooning.
Well, I guess you want me to just start, so I will.
Yep.
About 4.5 years ago, several of us got the idea that alongside the commercially available services like Virgin Galactic and Blue Origin that are selling suborbital rides to space for tourism, that a lot of people might like high-altitude ballooning up to altitudes where the Earth is curved and the sky is black, because you don't have to be as fit. And you get a lot more time than a suborbital flight, hours instead of minutes, and the costs are dramatically lower. So we started a company. We named it Worldview to get in that line of space tourism. Along the way, we found out that there are many other applications for these high-altitude balloons that have to do with everything from watching for fires over vast expanses of the Earth to crop monitoring to being of service, surveilling borders and battlefields, emergency communications over hurricane disaster areas, all kinds of things. And the company's been very successful. We've flown dozens of missions. We have customers that range from NASA to aerospace companies to universities. We fly payloads up to 140,000 feet. We fly all different kinds of sensors. We're based in Tucson, Arizona, and have almost 100 employees now. We build our own balloons, our own flight systems. We have our own mission control. And now that we're up and on our feet and really operating, flying multiple times per month, oftentimes, and heading towards much more frequent flights than that, we're turning back to also open the space tourism line, which I'm really excited about for tourism, but also because it will enable researchers to fly with their payloads and cut the costs of doing science on the edge of space.
Excellent. Sounds fantastic. So what's next for you? Is this going to consume you now, or is there another project that you foresee on the horizon?
I am committed to New Horizons throughout this extended mission, which ends in 2021. Mm-hmm. I'm involved in several other NASA space missions, like the one that's going to explore Jupiter's ocean moon Europa, and the newly selected mission called Lucy to explore primitive asteroids. I'm involved in the Rosetta project with the European Space Agency.
Wow. You're just having too much fun. This is
and
amazing.
There's Worldview, and there's a couple of books I'm writing, and I personally expect to fly in space suborbitally because I have tickets on Virgin Galactic, and I'll be flying with Worldview and probably others. What's next is I'm pretty booked through about 2021.
Very cool. Well, this has been an amazing story. Thank you for sharing your story about your upbringing and your inspirations and your career. This is fascinating. I'm envious. You're just having a whole lot of fun. So thank you for being on the show and telling us your story. It's been great. So let's finish up. Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Well, I think easiest is to find me on Twitter. It's very easy. It's just Alan Stern. I also have a Twitter feed for the New Horizons project called New Horizons 2015. And either of those works. And you can look me up on LinkedIn. So you can make a friend request on Facebook.
Cool. Listeners, consider yourselves duly inspired. This has been fantastic. And thanks for joining us this week. We'll see you next week on the Back Observer's Background Mode.